is a...
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Traditionally, the purpose of a college education was to learn new information, to expose yourself to ideas you may not have previously encountered. College was a time to open your mind and explore possibilities, even if they shook your worldview. Today, that seems to be changing. According to our guest today, Greg Lukianoff, a movement is arising, undirected and driven largely by students, to scrub campuses clean of words, ideas, and subjects that might cause discomfort or give offense. It's a hyper form of political correctness that has already driven some comedians from bringing their acts to campuses that had previously been fertile ground for new material. Those comedians, like Jerry Seinfeld, Bill Maher, and others, complain that this movement leads to a lack of a sense of humor among those who are too easily offended. Worse, this hypersensitivity is invading the classroom. Some professors and administrators acknowledge that certain thoughts and words may cause distress among the students, and those words and thoughts are best avoided. Greg Lukianoff spells this out in The Coddling of the American Mind, an article he co-wrote with Jonathan Haidt for the September issue of The Atlantic magazine. Mr. Lukianoff is a constitutional lawyer and president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE, and he joins us for the hour. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And because the shift in attitude is happening on college campuses, we thought it best to invite some representatives of higher education to be with us as well. David Spano is in his 13th year as Associate Vice Chancellor and Director of the Counseling Center at UNC Charlotte. A licensed psychologist, Dr. Spano oversees comprehensive health and wellness programs and services at the university, and we'll see how that plays into this in a few minutes. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Ann Fox is Professor of English at Davidson College, specializing in 20th and 21st century dramatic literature and disability studies. Her teaching interests include disability in drama, feminist theater, and contemporary American multicultural drama. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Nice to have you here. Now, we've all heard the expression, sticks and stones may break my bones, but names can never hurt me. It's something we all learned as kids. My grandmother used to say it all the time, but of course it's not true. Words can in fact hurt. Certainly names can hurt and words can hurt. But in your article, Greg, you're not talking about using words as slurs or even as acts of aggression, although they may be perceived as such by some students. But you write that's how they are received by some. And so I'm just curious as to when and why this started.
Well, I'm a First Amendment lawyer, and I actually went to law school specifically to do First Amendment freedom of speech law. And I worked for the ACLU of Northern California. I took every class my law school offered on freedom of speech and First Amendment. I even studied censorship going back to the 16th century. And I spent my first, I started in 2001 at FIRE. And I saw some of the most ridiculous cases of censorship for most of my career starting way back then. But most of what I was seeing was primarily coming from sort of administrative overreaction, which I liken in the article to the cognitive distortion of catastrophizing. Essentially, even relatively small things require an email to the entire university community, explaining, in one case at a real college, a joke from South Park, for example. So most of my career, it's been sort of administrators going too far and overreacting, in some cases because they're afraid of litigation. In the past 2 years, it's definitely been the case that I've seen a lot more, and this really saddens me because I've devoted a lot of my career to defending the free speech rights of students, is that a lot more of the push for speech policing or getting speakers that they don't like disinvited, it's been coming more from students. And I've written about this for years, but the difference of the article that I wrote with social psychologist Jonathan Haidt, in this one was we're trying to offer, rather than just grousing about it, we're trying to tell people about some of the psychological techniques used in a psychological intervention called cognitive behavioral therapy, and about how the main idea of CBT is simply to teach yourself to argue more fairly and rationally with yourself. And our only real innovation in the article is making the argument that, one, CBT is, incredibly well documented as being very effective at lessening anxiety and depression. But they're also just good rules for how to argue fairly and rationally. And what we're saying here is, why don't we apply this more to the way we argue with each other? Because I think that it would be hard to say that we couldn't do a better job as a society, as a community, of arguing more fairly and more rationally with each other.
I believe you just said, among many other things, that you've known this about this for a long time. So this is not new to you, and you wanted to put a spin on this article that gave some solutions and pointed into new directions, so perhaps we could alleviate some of this. But this really has come as a surprise to me. Your article came as a surprise, and I've just heard in the last couple of years from people like Bill Maher that he doesn't play college campuses. And I thought, well, what's up with that? And he said, because they have no sense of humor. They're offended by everything I say.
Yep.
Now, that may also come as a surprise to a lot of people who are not on college campuses every day. How about the two of you in the studio who are on college campuses every day? Have you noticed this on your campuses? Ann, I'll begin with you.
Sure. Well, you know, I have to say the question of people not having a sense of humor, I took a bit of umbrage at that because I find that is often the bully's defense. You know, you don't have a sense of humor about something, and therefore, you know, your opinion must be discounted. I have to say I didn't recognize a lot of what I see at Davidson College in this campus, or in this article.
Is that because that's Davidson College?
And
yes, they come
no.
there for a particular kind of education,
yes,
and from a particular background?
Yes and no. We have a lot of privilege at Davidson, but I think Davidson, like many educational institutions, is changing in terms of who makes up its student body. You know, this is no longer, higher education is no longer the province only of sort of the white upper class male, you know, student. And so who's represented, whose voice gets to come to the table is shifting. That's part of the educational process. You know, I've seen, we have discussion about things like microaggressions. We have discussion of things like trigger warnings. I've seen among my colleagues nationally discussions of this is a concern, and I've seen a lot of pushback at it.
Okay.
For me, though, the classroom is a space where we talk about what kind of language we use and what effect language has materially on our experience. And so I teach classes that do have things that are controversial within them. I teach a class called Representations of HIV/AIDS, where I start the class saying we're going to encounter some difficult material. But you sort of try to create a space where students can acknowledge what's going to be hard and talk with you about it. I found a lot of the examples in this article, as much as I'm allied with the cause of free speech, I mean, I'm a tenured professor. Tenure protects my freedom of speech. Davidson College protects my freedom of speech. At the same time, there wasn't a lot of discussion of actually what happens for me on a day-to-day basis in the classroom reflected in this article. There's also a lot connected to melding trauma and microaggressions in this article that, as a disability studies scholar, I would question a little bit. But I don't want to monopolize the conversation.
Right.
David, I want to sort of see what you think.
And we'll talk about microaggressions in a moment. David Spano.
Yeah, obviously UNC Charlotte is different than Davidson in many ways, but I also don't recognize UNC Charlotte in this article. You know, we're a state university with 28,000 students, very diverse. To paint all of our students with a broad brush, which I think this article does, I think does a disservice to our students. Many of our students have a great sense of humor and an irreverent sense of humor. But you also have to consider the voices of students who are trauma survivors, students who are LGBTQ, students who are students of color and might hear remarks that offend them. And to say to them that they just need to think about that differently or that they need a sense of humor in order to get over it, I think does disservice to them. And I think while I think the article is excellent, provocative, I think some of those voices are missing in this article.
Well, the sense of humor I brought into this conversation, and it's a tiny part of Greg's article here, but you do open your article with three examples of things that are happening. It may not be happening at Davidson. It may not be happening at UNC Charlotte, but it has happened. You reference an online article for the New Yorker, an online article for the New Yorker about law students asking professors at Harvard not to teach rape law, or in one case even use the word violate, as in that violates the law, lest it cause students distress. You talk about a professor at Northwestern University who, in an essay, described a new campus politics of sexual paranoia. and who was then subjected to a long investigation after students who were offended by the article and by a tweet she'd sent filed Title IX complaints against her. And you quote, "someone who describes himself as a liberal professor who is terrified by his liberal students." So if these things are happening, are these just three good examples, the three best examples, or could you have used more had you had the space to do so?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that's been one of the funny things as far as criticism is, like, well, there's just not enough examples in it. I'm like, the original article we wrote, we tried to make 2,000 words long, and the authors, the editors of The Atlantic, it's the only time I've ever been asked to write a longer article. And so that's an 8,000-word article. I've also written a 90,000-word book called Unlearning Liberty and another shorter book called Freedom from Speech, just filled with examples, and there's still a tiny percentage of the ones that I use. Now, and what I do hear from pretty much, you know, depending on what show I'm on, I hear from a lot of professors call in and say, yeah, I'm really concerned about this. I really am concerned that it's much too easy to say the wrong thing and that I'm going to get brought up on charges on my campus. And then I hear from, in a lot of cases, in some cases, administrators saying, no, nothing to see here. And one thing that I'm perfectly happy to, you know, hear all sides on this. But when it comes to the issue of comedy, which I definitely wanted to circle back to, I became so interested in the topic of campuses becoming places that comedians didn't want to play anymore after I wrote my first book, which, again, the only criticism that I got on Amazon of my first book was that people got sick of hearing examples in it. I did a podcast at the Comedy Cellar in New York. That's Louis C.K.'s, where he does comedy. And Lee Camp, who was the self-described most liberal person on the comedy panel, said that he didn't like doing campuses anymore because it was just people were looking as if they had a will to be offended. And generally, you know, people talk about diversity. Generally, it was upper-class white students who were looking for the opportunity to be offended.
You know,
that were almost seeking it out. So we're making a documentary called Can We Take a Joke? That involves interviews with, you know, six or seven major comedians talking about this problem, about how they've seen this increase in the tendency to want to be offended. And Gilbert Gottfried, believe it or not, actually has some surprising wisdom, is that we've come to see claims of being offended almost like a declaration that you're a good person, almost like you did something if you were offended.
Hmm. So being offended is like a badge of honor because you're defending those who have been maligned? Is that you're looking at me funny, Ann?
Well, I think it's interesting because I think painting the desire to be offended as a badge of honor, again, is sort of painting with a broad brush this idea of there are people who may have legitimate concerns. You know, when I teach about language, for example, related to disability, I tell my students, I'm not trying to shame you or police you when I question your language. I'm trying to invite you to think about the effects it has. And when we who are questioned are uncomfortable with that act of questioning and say people don't have a sense of humor, we basically silence and say, well, there's no space for questioning at all. It just really concerns me, this binary that's being set up between the humorless questioner, you know, and the question, who often has the privilege.
I took a class as a freshman in a big lecture hall at the university, about 300 students, and it was on human sexuality. And before the professor on the opening day of class said a word, even introduced herself, she wrote every word you can possibly imagine for every body part and sex act in terms of the clinical nature of it and also the slang nature of it. And I'm thinking that would have offended a lot of people today. And she said, these are just words. This is what we're going to talk about. Get over it.
Which is a trigger warning back in the day. We just didn't call it that.
Okay. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more of this conversation in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and LRC, Language Resource Center, providing professional interpreters and translators for spoken and sign languages, including document translation, on-site, phone, and video interpreting. Details at languagerc.com. Well, tomorrow at 9 o'clock on this program, we get a behind-the-scenes look at the White House during the Clinton years. You know, I want to move that curtain aside, but when Melinda Bates was director of the White House Visitor's Office, keeping up with celebrity visits, the Easter egg roll, welcoming dignitaries, power brokers, was her job. She's kind of the ultimate White House insider. She will join us first on the program tomorrow. And then we'll take a look at some books that you might want to add to your late summer, early fall reading list. You and the kids, as a matter of fact. That's all tomorrow at 9.
On the next Iron Rain show, Islamic State militants had blown up an ancient temple in Palmyra and beheaded a renowned antiquity scholar. Recent atrocities by ISIS and understanding the terror group's broader strategy for power.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about a new form, I guess, of political correctness in the classroom with Greg Lukianoff, who is the co-writer of an article in the September issue of The Atlantic magazine, The Coddling of the American Mind. He is also CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. And Fox is a professor of English, specializing in disability studies and feminist literature and drama at Davidson College. Dr. David Spano is Associate Vice Chancellor and Director of the Counseling Center at the University of North Carolina here at Charlotte. Do people in the classroom, do students in the classroom have a right not to be offended?
I think the answer to that is no. I think that things in the classroom are going to happen, and I think when folks are offended, that can be a good thing because it can open dialogue. And so I think not. In fact, you know, if I say something in a classroom or to a student that's offensive and I've done that and they tell me that they're offended by it, I have to listen to that. And I can't say to them, no, you're not.
What do you say to students whose worldview when they come to college is one thing and suddenly you're telling them things that either they've never heard or that they and their parents would extremely disagree with?
This precise example is happening at Duke right now, by the way, just to interrupt, just because there's a story in the news that precisely exemplifies why we should be concerned about some of the intellectual habits we're cultivating.
You're talking about Fun Home?
About Fun Home, yeah.
Yes. Fun Home is a book that was written by a lesbian. It's now a Broadway musical that's won a Tony Award, a couple of Tony Awards, and it was part of the summer reading for Duke University students, and some of the Christian students refused to read it. Why?
Because they thought it challenged their worldview, and because it had depictions of, according to them, I actually ordered the book as soon as I heard about the controversy, because I'm like, oh, it sounds like something I'd want to read. Because apparently it had pictures displaying a lesbian relationship, I guess. And my overall thinking is that this is a big part of the problem, is that my shorter book, Freedom from Speech, talks about how I think we're cultivating in students more of an idea that they should be protected from speech than exposed to it. And I think that that can end up having really negative long-term consequences.
See.
And I think that ideally, if we really want to train, and, you know, of course, these are people coming up from K through 12, and we haven't had a chance to really train them yet. But I think the goal, ultimately, would be to cultivate a sense of genuine curiosity and suspicion of one's own confirmation bias. So if someone says, hey, there's a lot of things that you're going to disagree with and it's going to challenge your worldview in this book, that our attitude as scholars and as people being educated would be, oh my goodness, let me read that, as opposed to, I'm opting out of this assignment.
And I know you want to chime in.
Well, I think what's ironic is College of Charleston went through this a year or two ago with Fun Home from the opposite end, where they were censored by the state. There was an attempt at censoring the use of Fun Home by the state government. So it cuts both ways. I think
But it's one thing for conservative politicians.
That's the same thing, though.
Well, let me finish. I mean, I think, you know, I've had students who've had those kind of reactions who have had a very powerful reaction because they're coming to a liberal arts college and encountering worldviews that they've never experienced. As a teacher, that for me is a pedagogical opportunity. That's a place for me to engage them in conversation.
So how do you react to students at a university like Duke, of all places, of students coming and saying, I'm not reading that because it challenges my worldview? My question would be to them, why are you coming to Duke University?
Well, my question would be, tell me a little bit more about where you're coming from. My question would be meeting them where they are and trying to engage them in a discourse about it rather than sort of saying, oh my God, you're trying to shut down conversation, you're trying to censor. I think you know, my job as an educator is to sort of ask them why they find that offensive, to tell them why I'm bringing it to the table, to talk to them about why Fun Home. You know, it's not just about the depiction of lesbian sex. It's about a young woman coming to terms with her identity. It's about a young woman whose father lived a very different identity as a closeted gay man. It speaks to sort of our relationship with our parents. You know, those are things I, as a literary critic and as their teacher, can talk with them about and try to help them see the work in context rather than sort of say, get over it, which is a very individualist mindset, which is a very typical mindset in terms of how we think that in education, emotion, where someone's, you know, living intellectually at that moment can't enter in the classroom. They have to sort of, you know, get over it, right?
Right. Sorry. Well, I'm not a classroom teacher, but I know that one of the ways that we help students grow is to help them, to challenge them and support them. But we need to balance challenge and support in order for growth to happen. If we over-support them, and I think Greg's article makes great points about sometimes we do try to over-support students and therefore they don't grow. We also have to meet them where they are. If we over-challenge them, if we have them read books that they're not ready to read and do what Anne suggests, rather, which is to meet them where they are, talk about what is uncomfortable about that for them.
You know,
that starts a dialogue that can be.
I know that I'm a dinosaur waiting to die. I know that. But this, I don't think that these kinds of conversations and these thoughts were going through the minds of the people who taught me in college. I just don't think they cared one way or the other, and I certainly didn't want to be protected or coddled or supported in any way. I was there to get an education.
Well, I think part of this, too, is reflecting the changing demographics of college populations, a changing understanding of what constitutes history and literature and whose histories get told. I think it also, as I said before, you know, in terms of thinking about who belongs in a classroom, for so long we've thought about that presence as a mind divided from a body with emotional and lived experiences. And we can't do that anymore.
Greg, you write about how sometimes being exposed, people believe that being exposed to some of these ideas that they have never heard before, they might find challenge their worldview, can be somehow damaging to them. Is that coming from the fact that we are living already in an increasingly secularly polarized society? Is it coming from the fact that we have raised a generation or two of kids now with helicopter parents who have protected them from everything in the world? And when they hear something that shakes their worldview, they take umbrage as a result. What's it coming from?
Well, I do want to address one thing first. I didn't, it's partially that I do think that, you know, talking about my article presenting things as zeros or ones, unnecessary binaries, I don't think it's actually doing that. And I think when it comes to painting from a broad brush, yes, I am trying to diagnose a particular problem that I've seen with increased frequency. But the intervention we're suggesting is not toughen up, Buttercup. It's actually referring to a therapeutic modality that is actually, in many ways, in the great traditions of, you know, Stoicism and Buddhism, saying, we need to teach people better to talk back to their own internal dialogue and how to more productively talk to each other. So criticizing the fact that, and by the way, my organization, FIRE, was very much fighting the fact that the state government also was threatening defunding and was defunding over books they didn't like. We thought that was much more outrageous than the current situation at Duke and much more much more of a legal issue. And unfortunately, it didn't get nearly as much coverage as the current issue, but when it comes to sort of, you know, where it comes from, I do think that, yeah, I think we've been telling students this isn't all students. I always kind of try to assume that people understand that when you're making generalizations, you're not saying everybody. That we have been, particularly for more privileged kids, there has been unfortunately, I think, an overemphasis on fragility, on saying that you are a very vulnerable person. And the problem with that way of thinking is that it ends up being, to some degree, a self-fulfilling prophecy. And what we're saying in the piece is that there are tools that can help us believe in ourselves, you know, to a degree, to understand our own resilience to a degree, and to argue more productively as individuals.
So as a psychologist and a counselor, can exposure to new ideas, can being offended actually do psychological damage? Can words or ideas become a source of trauma?
It can. And I think it really depends on who's doing it and the timing. I mean, I think, you know, one of Greg's points is that we can learn to think differently about our experiences and be more resilient. It's a great point. But I don't think it just happens as a result of, you know, some classroom experience. I think students who are trauma survivors in particular, and let's just use them as an example, need to work through some of their experiences with a therapist. I mean, CBT is a great example of a way to do that. There's a particular kind of CBT called trauma-focused CBT, but it's a process. And if you get a student who's early in that process or who hasn't even begun that process, then being in a classroom where offensive material is presented can be re-traumatizing and can be a tremendous setback for that person.
Giving an example of something that might be said in the course of coursework in the classroom that might be a traumatic event for a student?
Well, if a student is a trauma survivor, has experienced rape, for example,
okay,
and there's material that depicts extreme misogyny or maybe even graphic descriptions of sexual assault or a family experience that might be abusive, that can get hit close to home, and they may see their own experience in those examples, and as I said, it could be a setback for that person.
I just want to add that I think painting fragility or somebody who's living with trauma as a problematic thing is in itself kind of problematic, as though, you know, there are many people, both faculty and students, who are living with trauma, working through trauma. And it's not, you know, to sort of suggest that they just need to get over it or get past it doesn't acknowledge the mutability of that
right.
state of being, or that it belongs in the classroom, just as somebody else who has a different kind of neurodiversity belongs in the classroom.
It is mutable. You don't want to protect them forever from those experiences, yeah. but you want to make sure that they are in the process of working through that.
Yeah. Greg.
I would really like to emphasize, and this is about the third time this has come up, the article is not saying just get over it. And what we're talking about are different ways to engage and to have to give people tools so that they can actually deal with trauma, to actually live in the world as it is. So I don't really understand why one of the speakers seems to think that we're being dismissive of people with trauma when we're actually recommending one of the best ways for dealing with trauma, CBT.
Yeah,
I think what I'm suggesting, though, is that the trigger warning can be as much a way to opt in, not just opt out. And so, you know, to sort of say the trigger warnings prevent.
Well,
I think I have a sort of hesitation.
For those who are not in academia, yeah, and for those who have not read this article, let's define some terms here. Trigger warnings. Mm-hmm. You talk about trigger warnings, Greg, in your article, which you say are alerts that professors are expected to issue if something in a course might cause a strong emotional response. These are like those things you see at the beginning of television shows. Parental discretion is advised.
Right.
Viewer discretion is advised. Do you just say in the classroom, what I'm about to say may upset some of you, may offend some of you, and if so, what are they supposed to do with that information? Are they allowed to get up and leave? What's the deal?
Well, I think you do say that when you know that something might be upsetting to people. We do a program for our resident advisors every year.
But it's not just a thing about things about rape. It's about talking about slavery in this country, the history of slavery. That might be offensive to a lot of black people. Are they supposed to? You're supposed to say, we're going to talk about slavery, and if it offends you, you get up and leave?
I think that's an extreme example. I mean, I think part of what we need to think about, too, is that classes are very different, and that a student, by nature of choosing a particular class, you know, a class on slavery, understands that there's going to be that kind of material. You know, I don't get up in front of every class every day and say, you know, here's your warning. But I try to create a classroom space through different kinds of strategies where students understand if they have a concern, they can come to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually not – I don't actually put trigger warnings on my syllabi,
right,
but I try to create a classroom community where they can feel free to have –
And somebody in this conversation mentioned the term microaggression, which is also covered thoroughly in this article. But, Doctor, you say there's a – and these are words that are said or statements that are made that are perceived by the receiver to be mean or aggressive. That's why they're called microaggressions. Hate speech, and you say there's a fine line between microaggression and hate speech. Give me an example of a microaggression being used.
Well, an example of a microaggression would be, I think there's some examples in the article, for example, where you know, somebody who is a student of color is asked a question about, you might make a comment about somebody who's African American that they're very articulate, and you might make that observation. I mean, Joe Biden notoriously made that comment
about the president.
So that's an example of a microaggression that might not be something that the speaker recognizes as offensive, but is perceived as offensive.
And you say, Greg, you have examples in the article. You say that asking a question of a Latin American or Asian American student, like "Where were you born?"
right,
can be seen as a microaggression.
Well, and I want to be very clear about microaggressions. I think they're a great area for study, and I think that that's the example, my go-to example, too, is the classic example of someone saying, to an African-American student, you're very articulate, because, that's implicitly quite insulting. But what we're concerned about, and what I'm primarily concerned about, is when you turn from studying to policing and policing outright. And there was a program that they started up at Ithaca College that the idea was to, to actually consider disciplinary offenses for people who were microaggressing, and to keep track of who the perpetrator was and who the microaggressed against was. And this really concerns me, partially because I think they think it's going to improve the way people talk to each other. But if you say that you can unconsciously slight someone and there's no way to actually refute the fact that you, no amount of saying that you had good intentions, that you, this is just the way the people you grew up talk to each other, for example, I was actually trying to be friendly. When you police at that level, you end up creating a situation where people aren't talking across lines of differences. They're just going to shut up, and you create a sort of talking on eggshells situation. Now, the other part of it that I see, frankly, and this is something I saw very much when I was at Stanford, is there's a huge class bias to this. Basically, a lot of the kinds of speech that people want to police, particularly at some of the more elite schools, when you really break it down, it's more or less saying, just like the old Victorians, we should all talk the way that we think that, for the most part, upper-class, white, Ivy League-educated people should talk. And I think that in an effort, if we're not spending more time listening and creating environments in which people have the safety to be wrong and to say what's genuinely on their minds and engage in genuine candor, we might actually be shutting down meaningful discourse in the name of promoting it.
Yeah, maybe it was you yesterday on the Diane Rehm show. Somebody got into a discussion about, in order to have to foster a civil discussion, and I'm paraphrasing here, we have to be willing to think the best of people and actually to cut them some slack for their opinions and the words they use. Otherwise, you're shutting it down completely.
Benefit of the doubt is something I've been saying a lot lately, and I think our worst selves, unfortunately, right now, and the worst ways we argue are probably represented on social media. And I was originally very much a social media booster. I actually was a huge fan of Twitter, but I do think that we've switched from this mentality where in 140 characters you have to assume you're not totally understanding what someone's saying or if they're being sarcastic or ironic, to one where, you said something slightly wrong, this is going to be my project for the day, is ruining your life. And I think that we have to practice some of these good intellectual habits, like giving people the benefit of the doubt. I think it helps conversations.
And you mentioned that you're protected by tenure, as professors are, but you're not protected in the world of social media. You can be lacerated, eviscerated, and taken to the ground in social media in a matter of moments.
Well, absolutely, but my life on social media, which is actually suspended right now because I found Facebook too onerous and too much of a time draw, is very separate from my life as a college professor. It's very separate.
But your students are talking about you on social media.
They may be, but they're not talking to me. I don't friend my students on Facebook.
Okay, we have to take a break. We're going to come back and talk more about where we go with this, how we deal with this, what the impact of this is, not only on students, but on education in general, when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte School of Law, offering a fully online corporate compliance certificate program for both lawyers and non-lawyers, accepting RSVPs for Lunch and Learn session September 9th and 23rd, info@charlottelaw.edu. Islamic State militants have blown up the ancient Temple of Baal Shemin in Palmyra and beheaded a renowned antiquities scholar. So on the Diane Rehm Show, coming up in 20 minutes, they take a look at recent atrocities by ISIS, and the terror group's broader strategy for power. That's coming up at 10 o'clock this morning. If you'd like to join our conversation, now would be your chance. You could email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. And we're coming right back.
It's scary out there. We know that. The Dow going crazy, China doing who knows what. So here's what we're going to do. Next time on Marketplace, another way to think about all this volatility from the guy who invented the volatility index. What this is all going to mean for U.S. businesses, both big and small. And of course, the rest of the day's business news and, oh yeah, the numbers from Wall Street. It's all from APM.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about political correctness, the new brand of it on college campuses, which was a spinoff of an article that Greg Lukianoff wrote along with Jonathan Haidt for the September issue of The Atlantic magazine. The article is called The Coddling of the American Mind. Dr. David Spain was with us as well, Associate Vice Chancellor and Director of the Counseling Center at UNC Charlotte, and Ann Fox, Professor of English at Davidson College. We mentioned social media a moment ago, and we put out a social media question about 30 minutes ago, and that question was, where should we draw the line between free speech and hate speech on college campuses? Here's what's been coming in as we've been talking. Sarah in Charlotte, as a liberal arts undergrad, I was sitting in my faculty advisor's office crying because I was being taught so many conflicting philosophies, it was rocking my personal belief system. He said, in class, you need to understand different ideas. That doesn't mean you have to believe them. It is your job to learn the difference. And that was probably the most important lesson I learned in college. Is that a lesson that's being taught, absorbed, believed, adhered to by students today?
I certainly hope so. I mean, I think that's the fundamental reason why we have liberal arts education, is for students to be challenged in that
way. But if you go into a situation where you think that reading a particular piece of material or hearing a lecture about something or a teacher saying a series of words to you is going to permanently damage you or traumatize you in some way, how can you do what Sarah did? How can you follow that advice?
Well, I think the onus is on us as educators to try to unpack a student's reaction. You know, we were talking about somebody having a strong reaction to a microaggression of, you're so articulate. Well, let's talk about what would cause that reaction. What are the stereotypes and beliefs about African Americans that have been used against them that would have caused that reaction? You know, I completely agree that we're not here to police language, but I would hope that our classroom spaces can be a place where our students are free to fail and make a mistake and stumble.
Shouldn't they also be places where people are free to say what they believe or what they think and then be taught otherwise?
Well, you know, that's kind of a presumption on my part that I know better.
The students themselves, because students can see comments by other students as being microaggressive.
I see, yeah. Well, you know, that does happen, and our job is to sort of negotiate that kind of disagreement.
Yeah, microaggressions aren't avoidable.
Yeah.
They're going to happen, and I think the point is to engage in dialogue when they happen and not to try to shut them down.
You ask a very interesting question in your article, Greg. You say, what exactly are students learning when they spend 4 years or more in a community that polices unintentional slights, places warning labels on the works of classic literature, and in many other ways conveys the sense that words can be forms of violence that require strict control by campus authorities who are expected to act as both protectors and prosecutors?
Well, and I mean, one thing that I do want people to understand is that, you know, I run a national organization that deals with abuses of academic freedom and freedom of speech, you know, across the country. And so I am very aware of the fact that I see the worst of it. But, for example, during the break, Anne was talking about creating safe spaces in which people can talk about the history of stereotypes, and I could not agree more. I could not agree more with her statement that we should allow for people to stumble and allow for people to make sort of verbal mistakes because, you know, as your other guest said, that it's impossible to avoid. But I have seen too many cases where even if people attempt to talk about taboo subjects, to talk about stereotypes, is itself considered to be a problem. So I talked about a case last night yesterday on the Diane Rehm show, which is a case out of Brandeis where a professor explained the awful history of the term wetback, a epithet for Mexican Americans primarily and for South Americans, And he explained where it came from in a Latin American studies class. And then he criticized its use. And he was found guilty of racial harassment. There was a case in University of Denver, and there were about three cases in a row where professors wanted to talk about things related to sexuality, things related to pornography. And in several cases, there were one professor at Appalachian State University, Jamie Price, was being critical of the pornography industry. And all of them were found guilty of harassment for the actual content of their classes. And one of them is out of a job. Jamie Price at Appalachian State. At University of Denver, we had to fight, and he's still under punishment. And we managed to get the professor at UC Boulder. She managed to keep her job. But we've created an environment, and I think we should not be so dismissive of the idea that we've created an environment where we could do a much better job for allowing for the stumbles and the misstatements and the weird things that happen when you have genuinely different people talking to each other.
James on Facebook writes, one might argue that the problem isn't just that people need to learn how to argue properly with each other, but that we live in a time, because of the technology-supported echo chambers in which we live, when people are disturbed by anybody arguing with their preconceived versions of the world, the polarization of modern life. Isn't students' fear of confrontation and disturbance related to this kind of intellectual isolation?
I just want to say I could not agree more. I actually write in other writings a lot about echo chamber effects and about one intriguing study that definitely more research needs to be done, but indicated that actually echo chamber effects tend to get worse the more education you have, that people who only have a high school education tend to get their news from sources that are more politically varied, whereas the people who get who have the least politically varied media consumption tastes are actually the most highly educated. So I do think we have an echo chamber problem. Now, a lot of these problems that we're talking about are actually the negative sides of otherwise positive things. I think it's great that we have wonderful media options. I think it's great that people are able to move into communities that better reflect their values. But the problem with it is we end up with groupthink issues, we end up with political polarization issues, which John Haidt has written a lot about, and people end up sort of sacralizing their core of beliefs and sometimes treat people who disagree with them like heretics. And higher education ideally would help teach people out of these habits. And one thing that I think would actually be very helpful as far as a good intellectual habit is that people should always be questioning themselves. If they're really, really confident about a belief, that's probably the time when you should read a book that actually challenges it.
Do you want to jump in there?
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think it's very important that we engage in that kind of dialogue on campus.
Adam writes, what happened to the concept of you do not have the right to not be offended? Let me read that again. You do not have the right to be not offended. You have the right to leave the room. Overprotective parents have bred a generation of sensitive, whining children. Words can't hurt you unless you let them, like many fathers have said in the past, and I quote here, grow a pair. Giselle, thanks for a terrific discussion. In traditional Judaism, there is a teaching that says it is an offense against God to be offended by anyone. This includes words or actions. It refers to seeking to understand first before making judgments. This is just one wisdom tool that can be used to help those who have particular traumas, sensitivities, or have yet to learn the skills and nuances of compassion, forgiveness, and kindness.
And I think that's where we need to focus our energy, you know, rather than on this specter of having to put warning labels on works of great literature, really focus on what are the strategies. And this is a long process for us as educators and as professors. We're constantly also learning how to shift within our classroom to create those kind of spaces for learning and empathy.
Peter on Facebook writes, in a time that if everybody gets a trophy and helicopter parents protecting kids from everything, it should not be surprising that college students are sensitive about everything. Earlier in this conversation, we talked about I'm not sure that they are fragile, but the perception of the fragility of these young people in college classrooms and how we have to be careful what we say to them and how we present information to them and give them a chance to opt out. I mean, this sounds like, it just sounds like we've raised a generation of people who can't cope?
We have recognized in the past few years that coping skills among students are not what they need to be. And in fact, there's a surging movement around the country, the resiliency movement. And we're trying to teach resiliency and coping skills.
Where does
to
that
students.
Come from? The fact that everything's been done for them, they've been protected all their lives, they were always exceptional children, they always got a trophy. Is that where it's coming from?
I mean, I think that's part of it. As a baby boomer parent, I plead guilty to trying to protect my kids from harm and from disappointment. And
because the article that Greg wrote asserts that rates of mental illness in young adults have been rising on and off campus. The rate of emotional distress reported by students themselves is also high and rising. And you're a counselor. Are you seeing that?
We are seeing more and more students use our services for counseling, yes. And that there's been a...
And does the source of their anxiety or their troubles come from what they're learning or hearing about in the classroom, or is it something else?
Well, I think it's a number of things. One is there's lower stigma about getting help, and I think that's a great thing. Students are seeking help in numbers that they never have before and probably should have in prior generations. I think that we're offering great, I think, gold standard psychological services on many of our campuses around the country. I wish that the community as a whole had accessible mental health services like our students do. There's tremendous word of mouth passed from student to student about the effectiveness of their services. And I think there is probably a higher level of stress in the world, and we're seeing higher levels of anxiety than we've ever seen.
And you agree with the authors, because you've said that the best way to help students overcome their anxieties is to have them confront those anxieties.
Absolutely. I mean, if you come to me and you have a fear of flying, I'm not going to give you a bus schedule. I mean, you might need to take the bus for a while we work together, but eventually I want to get you on that plane.
Well, what's the difference between if you have a fear of flying, fly, if you have a fear of elevators, take the elevator to overcome it? That's the only way you're ever going to overcome it, because if you avoid the elevator, you will always have the fear of the elevator. What's the difference between that and get over it?
Well, I think it's a process. Even somebody who's afraid of flying or afraid to get on an elevator, you just don't put them on the plane. You work with them. You have to help them recreate the narrative in their minds about what might happen if they get on that elevator or that plane. If you're working with trauma survivors, you help them recreate the narrative about their experiences so that there's not as much self-blame and as much fear of the world.
And I just want to add one thing here. Acknowledging these high rates of mental illness, acknowledging, you know, the sort of fragility, I don't think our students are so very fragile. I think we have to be careful. As a disability studies scholar, this is a classic way that disabled people have been defined as they're the problem. And we have to also look at the structures. How are the structures of higher education increasing pressures on students? How are expectations for the kind of work they're going to get after they graduate? All those, you know, we have to sort of look at those in tandem, which is, I think, something the article also talks about.
Yeah.
But as we focus on they're fragile, we can't forget the milieu in which they move and work.
And Greg, although you are a proponent of cognitive behavioral therapy and helping these young people get through the traumas and the problems that they're facing, you actually say that the use of trigger warnings in the classroom is hurting mental health on campus. If I'm not misquoting you, how so?
We think that they're problematic, and I think that it's partially because when you it depends on how they're used. But we definitely understand why professors, you know, the seven humanities professors wrote into Inside Higher Education about a year ago, only a couple months after the first time I'd ever even heard of what a trigger warning was, saying this is actually really scaring us because we're having professors and students and administrators writing us in saying you need to be providing trigger warnings before material, but we can't actually guess what students are going to say triggers or offends them. And I think that that's one of the reasons why the American Association of University Professors, you know, opposes trigger warning, certainly mandatory trigger warning programs. Now, I think it's up to ultimately the judgment of a professor if they want to warn students about content they're about to read, and it should always remain the professor's decision to do that. And as soon as it becomes mandatory, it becomes a real problem. But they should keep in mind that that if a student is actually suffering so badly that any discussion of, you know, Greek mythology in class is going to traumatize them, that it should be more the professor should be thinking more in terms of, wow, I really need to get this student some serious professional help because this is debilitating. And part of the problem, I think, and one of the dangerous things I think we've been teaching people since the 90s, and that I think that research, just like the resiliency that got mentioned before, is starting to indicate, is that you don't necessarily do people much favors if they've experienced trauma to say, you're kind of done for, that essentially you're always going to be this way. And the research is indicating that there are ways to overcome it. But unfortunately, what I think we're doing, and I think it's just a question of shifting more from an idea of fragility to an idea of resiliency, that we can actually be doing a better job of empowering students, giving them tools to make them happier, rather than saying, you know, you're done for.
Even if you do all these things, you have the trigger warnings, you guard against microaggressions in what the professor says or what students say to each other. If you're able to protect these students' sensibilities and provide what they and their parents consider to be this safe college environment, what happens when these students graduate and they go out into the real world where it's not populated by people who are studying microaggressions and even know the term microaggressions, where you're going to be in a meeting with somebody who's not going to say, oh, trigger warning, we're going to talk about something that may offend you? What happens to those people? How do they cope in that world?
We hope that their college experience gives them an opportunity.
How, when you're protecting them every step of the way? How?
I don't think we're protecting. I think what we're doing is creating, you know, I think my classroom is a dangerous space. And yet within that, I hope, I don't know, I could be fooling myself. But within that dangerous space, if I give a student permission to say, wow, you know, this is kind of rocking my world, I need to figure out how to deal with it, that to me creates access. It doesn't mean that the student is so debilitated they should leave my classroom. But if I can show some flex, I'm sort of modeling a different acknowledgement of who belongs there.
But if we are experiencing this now because of a generation of helicopter parents telling their children that they were special and unique and they're super achievers and here's a trophy for showing up, and they come to college and they have that worldview challenged, but then you start to coddle them, and then they go out into the real world, is IBM going to coddle them? Is the Bank of America going to coddle them?
I don't think we should coddle them, but I hope we're not coddling
them. Not at all.
But I think there are examples, obviously, of that. But I think in general, in my experience and Anne's experience, is that we're confronting students. We are helping them grow. We are confronting them with new ideas and challenging them to dialogue.
I want to thank Greg Lukianoff for setting us down this path today because of his article, The Coddling of the American Mind, a lengthy article, as he admits, which you can find in the September issue of The Atlantic magazine. He is also CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education and has written several books. You can look him up. You can Google him if it doesn't offend you. Dr. David Spano is Associate Vice Chancellor and Director of the Counseling Center at UNC Charlotte and Anne Fox, Professor of English at Davidson College. Thank you all for the hour.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7